From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. An iconic Richard Neutra house is seeking some TLC.
The right person really needs to open their heart to the house and to Neutra and to architecture first, and then open their pocketbooks to the restoration second, and really allow it to breathe and become something that no one's ever seen before. And that would be truly special.
Later in the show, we'll visit the Lovell Health House. But first, I'm sorry to say Los Angeles has yet again earned the dubious distinction as the nation's capital for dirty air. The American Lung Association's 2019 State of the Air report ranks the LA Long Beach metropolitan area the worst in the nation for ozone pollution for the 19th time. LA is also in the top 10 for worst year-round and short-term particle pollution. And that has real costs.
Air pollution has really profound effects on our health, not just our lungs. You know, I think we're all pretty ready to believe it. It could trigger asthma attacks and all of that, but it goes so much further.
Beth Gardner is author of the new book, Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution.
Air pollution is linked very strongly now by the scientific evidence to elevated risk of heart attack, of stroke, of dementia, of premature birth, a very long list of health problems, including the biggest health problem of them all, which is premature death.
We'll get back to LA in a moment, and we'll hear about a dispute over automation at the ports and what that has to do with air quality. But first, we're going to take a detour to some other cities, which may have it even worse than Los Angeles. Gardner has lived in London for 18 years, and after moving there, she wondered why the streets always smelled of exhaust fumes. That led her on a journey to study air pollution around the world, and she found that London's air is actually filthier than in New York and LA.
And that sort of surprised me as an American, because we're not used to thinking of ourselves as being out ahead of Europe on anything to do with environment. And generally speaking, we're not. Whether it's climate change or environment, we're usually bringing up the rear. But it happens that because of the very powerful and innovative and effective 1970 Clean Air Act, which was passed in Washington, and because of the power until recently of the EPA in enforcing that law and the regulations under it, the United States has significantly better air quality than London does.
Okay, fascinating discovery. London turns out to be dirtier than New York, and yet we do hear all the time about how we need to rein in carbon emissions. Are you saying that carbon emissions are not the same as air pollution?
They are not the same as air pollution. Carbon dioxide is not really a problem for your health if you breathe it in. It's obviously profoundly changing the world that we live in as it alters the climate. There are different pollutants that affect our bodies. The biggest one is, and the most dangerous one, is called PM2.5. It's these tiny particles that work their way very deep into your bloodstream and your organs, and they have really serious effects on the brain and the heart. 7 million people around the world die every year from the effects of air pollution. In the United States, it's 100,000. The UK, where I live, is somewhere around 40,000. And I think that the sort of more positive side of that is that the changes that we need to make to stabilize our climate are the same exact changes that we need to make to clean up the air. And those changes will bring not just this bigger picture benefit of a stable future for the climate and the planet, but also really immediate health benefits for human beings.
If you could just list the main offenders in terms of creating this polluted environment, what would they be?
Sure. So the biggest contributors to air pollution tend to be transportation. So that's cars, trucks, buses, and industry, including particularly power generation. So that's power plants, whether they're coal-fired or natural gas-fired. And in many parts of the world, also what I found in particularly Poland and China, is the use of coal for home heating, which is even more polluting than to, it's even worse to burn coal in a you know, sort of low-tech furnace in your home than it is in a big power plant, which is bad enough on its own. So when I traveled around Poland in particular, you know, it's just this heavy cloud of pollution, black smoke hanging over towns, and it comes straight from people's chimneys.
But London is different from New York, because in London, the cars run on
diesel.
So diesel is a big offender, is that right?
Yes, diesel is a big problem. And it's a really sort of long and tragic story, the European diesel disaster. And I experience it in London, but it's really continent-wide. Europeans have always been a little bit more drawn towards diesel than Americans. In most parts of the world, diesel is used for sort of really heavy vehicles, for buses and trucks and kind of construction equipment and that sort of thing. In the United States, it's about 1% of private cars are diesel. In Europe, it's at the peak in the UK, 50% of new car sales were diesel. And in places like Italy and France, it's sometimes as high as 70%. Diesel gets about 15% better mileage than gasoline. And the British government and other governments saw this as a sort of first step in shrinking carbon footprints. And a lot of people bought diesels with the best will in the world, that they were doing their bit, as they say, to help the environment and try to bring down climate emissions. But what happened is that the companies cheated. VW was the one that got into legal trouble, but actually all the diesel manufacturers, all the big car companies were making vehicles with these software codes written into them. It's known as a defeat device. And what that device was able to do was detect when the car was being tested for pollution. And when it was being tested, the controls switched on and the car met the legal requirements. And when the car was out on the road, not being tested in a lab, the emissions of this pollutant called nitrogen dioxide, which is very toxic gas, harmful to your health, went through the roof. It's more expensive to put this equipment onto a diesel vehicle that really sort of properly cleans up the emissions than it is to cheat. So they cheated.
So let's actually circle back to LA and California. You mentioned that it was the Clean Air Act as well as the EPA that has really enabled America to see its air quality get better. And yet, right in LA now, we are having quite a significant problem
yes.
with air pollution. It seems that on the one hand, we've gotten rid of smog, but on the other hand, air pollutants are on the increase, and we're seeing more and more housing being built in areas that are high in air pollutants.
Yeah, well, one thing that I learned in reporting in LA is that there's sort of this contradiction, this paradox. LA's cleaning up of the air over many decades is very often described, and I think rightly so, as one of the great environmental success stories of all time. The air here is so much better than it was in the 70s, 80s, even the 90s.
When you couldn't even see the mountains.
When you couldn't see the mountains. However, LA still has some of the worst air in America, despite California and LA regionally having really very aggressive regulation. And, you know, the thing that sort of explains that is that as the regulation has gotten tighter and as cars have been forced to get cleaner and cleaner, they're 99% cleaner now than they were in the early 1970s American cars, largely because of California's regulatory muscle. But there are so many more of them on the roads. And the other thing is that over time, as the air has gotten better, the goalposts are moving because the scientific research is advancing as well. And what the science, and a lot of it comes from LA, from USC and UCLA, big scientific teams focused on air quality and health. The science is telling us that levels of pollution that once would have been seen as miraculously low, today's levels, are still actually doing real damage and killing people and causing all kinds of illnesses. So, you know, the challenge remains.
And also in LA, we have trucking, and we have trucking actually that goes right through downtown LA,
yeah.
close to LA River.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people living there and more people living
yeah.
there. In fact, as that part of LA is really growing up. Are the trucks as clean as the cars in LA?
You know, there's been a real effort on the part of the state of California to force trucks to get cleaner. And it's been a significant benefit. And one thing that was, you know, quite forward-looking about it was that generally speaking, on a federal level, when trucks are regulated, the new regulation only applies to new trucks, and drivers keep their trucks for decades. So it can take a very long time for the benefits to sort of trickle down into the real world. You talk about this issue of housing and density of development, And, you know, it's a really tricky question because from a climate perspective, of course, we want development to be denser and
close to mass transit.
Yeah, and help people to get out of their cars. So I guess it, you know, feels pretty intuitive also to think that if you are living right next to a big freeway crowded with cars and trucks and all that, you know, or you're going to school in a classroom right on a major road, that that's going to have health impacts.
That was Beth Gardner. She's author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Now, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti is trying to tackle LA's poor air quality in his Green New Deal. He's called on Angelenos to ratchet up the number of electric or zero emission cars they drive, or to simply drive much less. He also wants to see improvements at the ports, which contribute to LA's poor air quality. And right now, APM Terminals is in a dispute with the longshoremen over automating cargo handling activities. The company claims that automation will help reduce diesel and greenhouse gas emissions. In what way? We asked David Pettit. He's a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC.
Well, there's really no connection between automating the ports and cleaning the air. The connection is when the equipment is electrified or otherwise converted to zero emission. It could be hydrogen fueled or the like. But you can have automated equipment that's diesel powered, and that is not cleaning the air. We already have diesel powered equipment, which is making the air filthy. So the real issue to me isn't whether the equipment is automated or not, but whether it is zero emission or not. And I think that issue is getting lost in the heat, if you will, of the dispute between APM and the Longshore Union.
So is APM using the claim of automation being a tool for cleanliness as a kind of smokescreen to really distract from the fact that this is a labor issue and they want to cut costs?
Well, I think they do want to cut costs. One thing they could do if they wanted to is they could fully automate using diesel-powered equipment. That would cut their labor costs, but it would be terrible for air quality. So there's a practical relationship among the two, but it's just a mistake to say that automation by itself will lead to cleaner air at the ports or anywhere else.
How could you automate in a way that would clean the air?
Well, to automate and clean the air, you would need to go to a zero emission system. There are already two systems like that here locally, one at the Port of LA and one at the Port of Long Beach, where much of the cargo handling, you know, the moving those huge containers around the yard and stacking them and the like, where most of that work is done all by electric powered equipment, which is almost fully automated. And those terminals are very clean compared to the older ones where everything is run by diesel equipment. So that is happening right now. And I think what APM wants to do is have a container yard that is competitive with those others in terms of their labor costs.
Got it. NRDC does a lot of work around air quality. What kind of changes would you like to see at the ports?
The most bang for the buck that we could get at the ports is to get rid of the diesel truck fleet. Because as you know, the cargo movement doesn't stop when a container is stacked up on the port somewhere. The contents of it go all over the country. About half stays local and half goes elsewhere in the U.S., and swapping out those diesel trucks and diesel trains for electric would be the single biggest improvement that we can make. But it comes down to two things. One is cost and one is availability. The electric trucks tend to have a larger upfront cost than the diesel trucks. And right now, as we speak, there are electric trucks on the market that will get about 100 miles range. So if you're a driver and you want to take, let's say, 3 loads a day out to the Moreno Valley and back on a single charge, there is no truck right now as we speak that will do that. And we're trying to get the ports on a trajectory so that when those trucks are available, they will be put into the fleet.
Before speaking with you, we spoke with a lady named Beth Gardner. She's written a book called Choked. It looks at air quality the world over. And she found, intriguingly, that London's air is just ghastly, along with other European cities, because there's more use of diesel-powered cars. And she says that actually LA is doing pretty well on the car front, except that there's so many of the cars that the sheer numbers of cars kind of offset the gains in the cleanliness of the cars. Does that sound about right to you?
It does. And you should go to Beijing if you want to see some really bad air that cars are contributing to. I grew up here in LA, and yes, the air is a lot better than it used to be, even though we have many, many more cars than we did when I was a kid. And a lot of that improvement can be traced directly to regulations adopted in California that have affected and improved auto exhaust emissions over the decades. And if I can put in a slight pitch to some work I'm doing, this is an area where the Trump administration is now trying to roll back some of these protections, and which we're opposing.
That was David Pettit. He's senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, Richard Neutra's classic Lovell Health House is desperately in need of some loving attention.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. For the last 30 years, classic LA modernist houses by the likes of Richard Neutra, Rudolf Schindler, Pierre Koenig, John Lautner and others have been bought, lovingly restored and have soared in value. But one of the most iconic of LA's early 20th century homes has not gotten this treatment. We're talking about the Lovell Health House.
Well, mission number one is hopefully there is people I know that are interested in the house, and they're the right people. So mission one for a place like this would be taking it all the way down to the bones, basically.
Hear from Josh Gorell, preservationist, in a moment. The Lovell Health House was built at the edge of Griffith Park in the still wild hills of Los Feliz in 1929. It was designed by Austrian immigrant architect Richard Neutra for a physician and naturopath named Dr. Philip Lovell. Lyra Kilston describes the house in her recent book, Sunseekers, The Cure of California.
It's a full, almost kind of machine for healthy living. And there's every single bedroom has a outdoors to its own sleeping porch. There were sort of private areas where you could do your nude sunbathing, which was essentially akin to like taking your vitamins every day.
You may have seen the house when it served as the scarily Spartan home of drug and porn king Pierce Patchett in the movie L.A. Confidential. It has a machine-made aesthetic reinforced by details like two Ford Model A headlights that are in the main stairwell. But the sleek, international-style white stucco and metal frame building has lost its sheen. So a group of Neutra devotees gathered there recently to figure out how to generate support for the house. Maybe through inviting people to visit through tours, maybe through even luring in the right buyer. George Smart co-hosted the party. He's the voice of the podcast US Modernist Radio.
You can see why it was so incredibly popular when it first got released and why thousands of people came to visit it. I mean, this was one of the early California modernist houses that kicked off several crazes. One was modernist architecture. The other was health, the idea that being outdoors was better for you and paying attention to what you eat was better for you and getting some exercise was better for you. Those were novel concepts at the time. People didn't think about that very much.
What appeals to you about it in its modernist dimension?
Well, one thing is that you have this idea of bringing the outside in. So you've got these great windows that bring in the sun, and you can open them up, and you can bring in the breeze. And then you can go to different levels in the house for different experiences based on time of day. There's a lovely aquamarine pool on the outside that you can swim in if you want to. It's pretty fabulous.
The pool George mentioned is no longer aquamarine. Instead, it's empty and dried out. The white stucco wall alongside it is faded and paint is peeling on its window frames. Betty Topper lives here with her son, Ken. Her late husband bought the house in 1960.
My father played here as a kid with the Lovell boys. And so I guess he just, you know, fell in love with the house and came 1960. They were looking for a house, not necessarily this house. And then, you know, when my dad bought it, it was kind of a surprise to my mom. And so she wasn't like thrilled with that at first. It's like all glass, a lot of stairs, little kids. So that's not the ideal combination. But obviously we've made it work. And she's, I'm sure, thrilled that she's, you know, here 60 years.
Do you remember any sense that this was kind of a rather special house to grow up in?
No, it was just like our house. But that question was always asked, like, what's it like to live here? Oh, my gosh, it's like, you know, like, must be so special. And I can remember is like spilling something, getting in trouble for breaking something, you know, painting a wall or whatever. You do it to your house and your memories of it. But as I've gotten older and come back through, I hear people in awe of it, and I begin to recognize, you know, features and people telling me, you know, why it's so special, why it's so important to keep it, you know, in its original condition. I mean, that's always been what my mom's tried to do in the 60 years we've been here. She's really changed almost nothing.
But there were some changes made before 1960, and that has preservationists itching to restore the house to its original state, including Josh Gorell.
Large spaces were enclosed, windows were added, the Grey Greens addition to this office with the warmer woods. To me, it's like someone took a Picasso painting and painted an area that's red, yellow, so it could match their dining room. So my first thought is, let's bring this back to 1929. Let's not think about it. Let's just do what the master did, because I really don't feel like anybody's actually seen this house that's still alive or has a photograph of it.
Josh, what was this house like in 1929?
It's if you look at like the rookie year of sports stars, right? This is Richard Neutra's rookie year. And he had such an attention to detail. I mean, the textures and the surface areas and his attention to everything that made the human experience a great house and a life from having a great house.
Now, this is one of those odd situations where Lovell House fans feel as much of a sense of ownership of the house as the actual owners. And they're trying to intervene to save the home from further degradation. I asked Ken Topper if he's looking for a buyer.
There's been no knock on the door. We're always open to someone knocking on the door, but no one knocks on the door with a number, so I can't say.
Josh, what do you think is a range for a house like this now?
The comps on this area, I think, were like 4 to 5. Add in the Neutra element and the specialty of the house. You know, it's hard to comment on that stuff. What I can say is that it would be truly horrific if someone with a lot of money comes in and makes it a comfortable place to live. The spaces are small. It's not as big as people think. It just isn't. And it's also like one of those houses that just kind of should be privately owned, but publicly accessed. I mean, it's a very, very important cultural element, not just to Los Angeles, California, but to the world and to the design community, architectural community in general. And I think the right person really needs to open their heart to the house and to Neutra and to architecture first, and then open their pocketbooks to the restoration second in a correct format and really allow it to breathe and become something that no one's ever seen before. And that would be truly special.
But eventually, maybe, Ken, do you have any plans to try and do any kind of restoration?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, you know, under my family's control, but I guess the ultimate goal is to see it get to somebody that has those resources to put it back to its original condition.
So basically, the Lovell House, which is an iconic house, may possibly be in some transition. It may wind up in different hands, and you guys, talking to you now, are concerned about its well-being, its future well-being.
Right, because if you want a Spanish villa, don't buy this house and turn it into one. That's rule number one. And rule number two is, when your cousin Earl says that he can do the modifications to fix it up and bring it back to its original glory. Earl cannot do that. You need someone who knows what they're doing. This is true in all states, all 50 states. Earl cannot handle it.
But maybe Josh can. So, Josh, what are the modifications that need to be done here?
There is a lot to do on this house. It is frightening, to be honest with you.
What's mission number one?
Well, mission number one is hopefully there is people I know that are interested in the house, and they're the right people. So mission one for a place like this would be taking it all the way down to the bones, basically. And thankfully, it is a steel frame construction. And also, I think the key is preserving original areas as best as possible. This is all steel, glass, and stucco. So if there's ever something that can be taken back to quote-unquote brand new, Neutra is like perfect for it. You really can get in there and make everything look pristine, and then it'll actually shine just like it did from day one. And I think that was kind of Neutra's intention.
George, do you want to give us any last words?
You know, if you are hearing this and you are thinking, well, I'm not a purist. I got a 64-inch TV I want to put in somewhere. Josh probably can make a secret panel that the front of it is all Neutra, and you just slide it aside, and there's your 64-inch television. So this is possible, folks. Don't let that deter you.
I was just going to add that I guess that my mom had recognized the difficulty of adding anything here, because she always said it's very difficult to decorate or add furniture or anything. But she managed to do it. And one of the things when people do tour the house and they go through the kitchen, there's a very simple clock up there. It's just like with stick-on numbers. And so she didn't get something fancy or anything. She just went out to the store, bought the stick-on, you know, pieces herself and put the clock up there. And it's still there. And it still works, just like most of this house is. It's still here. It still works.
And then Josh will come in and rip the clock off the wall, I have a feeling.
It's the first thing to go.
That was preservationist Josh Gurell, Ken Topper, who lives in the Lovell House with his mom, and George Smart of US Modernist Radio. Tomorrow is Betty Topper's birthday, and it will be marked by the arrival of Josh Gurell. He's going to become a resident of the Lovell Health House. He's taking a room by the pool deck, and that will give him a great vantage point to monitor any changes to the house. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced this episode with a final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Laura Kondaradjian. Finally, this is the last week of KCRW's UnDrive, and that means it's my last chance to reach out to you. And first of all, thank you for your support of DNA. Please consider using this opportunity to join KCRW as a member or renew your subscription if you're already with us, and perhaps add a few more dollars. It is only on shows like this that you can get into the heads and hearts of obsessive preservationists at LA icons like the Lovell Health House, or hear stories about the local impact of today's dramatic technological changes like automation at the ports. So, if that's the kind of programming you want to listen to, please support it. If you value the stories you hear on DNA or Press Play or Greater LA, or the music played by our DJs, or the events that KCRW hosts across the region, then please take a few moments, go to kcrw.com/join. KCRW is your community voice, and we rely on your support to keep us going. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.